Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
It's only a kick, a jump, a block, it's only a serve, it's only a tackle, a run, it's only for the fans. After all, it's only pressure. You got this. Adidas.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome back to the New Books Network. I'm Rachel Pagonis, and I'm your host for this episode. Today, I'm speaking with Alan Shuback about his book, Hollywood at the Races, Film's Love Affair with the Turf, published by the University Press of Kentucky in 2019. Alan Shuback has worked as a columnist and foreign correspondent for the Daily Racing Form and was the American correspondent for the British racing daily, The Sporting Life. He's the author of Global Racing, The Complete Guide to the Greatest Foreign Race Courses, and a contributor to Bet with the Best, Expert Strategies from America's Leading Handicappers. Shuback writes frequently on the convergence of horse racing and the film world. And Alan, welcome to the show.
Glad to be here, Rachel.
Well, I am delighted to have you here because, as you know, horse racing is a passion and a former professional pursuit of mine. So to begin, would you tell us a bit about your own background and how you became interested in the Hollywood racing connection?
Well, the connection actually started one Saturday afternoon. At home, I was watching television every Saturday afternoon at about 4 o'clock. There would be a Laurel and Hardy film on TV. And after the Laurel and Hardy film came Win Elliott's racing program. Win Elliott was a great racing announcer, and he would have a half hour show every Saturday at 5 p.m. One day, it was the Flamingo Stakes in 1957. This was a key early prep for the Kentucky Derby. And as Elliott was going down through the list of horses in the race, he mentioned one named Bold Ruler. I thought to myself, that sounds like a good name for a racehorse. I was only, 9 years old at the time. Hmm. Well, Bold Ruler won. It's called Beginner's Luck. Unfortunately, Beginner's Luck only works once. Bold Ruler went on to become, win the Preakness Stakes. He would be Sprinter of the Year, Handicap Horse of the Year, Horse of the Year, and leading stallion 7 times. Getting secretariat in his last crop, and I thought that's a pretty good start there. Anyway, watching the Flamingo Stakes that day and having a winner attracted me to racing, and I started following racing then. And that was the great 1957 3-year-old crop that included Bold Ruler, Gallant Man, Round Table, Iron Liege, and so many others. And really was probably the year where American racing actually first took an advantage over European racing.
So that was the racing, and you liked Laurel and Hardy too, obviously.
Yeah, well, there were lots of old films on TV in those days, and I used to watch, we had a program called Million Dollar Movie on WOR Channel 9 every night, And I can remember vividly watching King Kong for the first time and many, many, many times after that. It remains my favorite film. And as one grew older, one expanded one's horizons. And I just became more and more of a film fan until one day, my sophomore year at Northwestern University, I was told that down in Chicago, there would be a double feature of Ingmar Bergman films. I said, oh, well, that sounds good. I'll go see them. It happened to be The Seventh Seal and The Magician, and it was a life-changing experience because then I realized that film wasn't simply an entertainment, that it could really tell you something about your deepest inner emotions and feelings.
Hmm. And when did you realize there was a connection between Hollywood and horse racing?
Well, I've always been very interested in history, and as I got older, I noticed there were lots of racing films that had been made in the 30s, 40s, and 50s. And then when I started traveling around the world and from New York out to California, I just looked into the history of racing and discovered that all three of the major racetracks in Southern California, Santa Anita, Del Mar, and Hollywood Park, had been founded all or in part by people in the film industry in Hollywood.
Mm. Yeah, and I want to ask you about those in a moment. First, so thoroughbred racing has existed for centuries in Britain, France, and the East Coast of the United States. But the era you write about begins in the early part of the 20th century, and the locale is California. Presumably, the movie industry blossomed around this time as technology developed, but what led to the rise of the racing industry in California at the same time?
Well, it was the film industry. In Southern California, racing had been virtually abolished in 1909. There was a Santa Anita in those days run by Lucky Baldwin, but then conservative elements took offense at gambling, and the pari-mutuel laws were rescinded, and you couldn't get a bet down. So all racing really stopped. And then along comes at the same time the film industry. When Cecil B. DeMille went out to make a film in Southern California, it was called The Squaw Man, and this was like 1919, I believe. He went to Arizona with his crew and couldn't film there because there was a blizzard. So he got everyone back on the train, went out to Los Angeles, where there was always nice weather, and he made his movie there. He put up a studio in a barn that was about a block away from where Hollywood and Vine is now. And he made his first film right there. And it just blossomed, as everyone knows, throughout the 1920s, film took off. Now, there was lots and lots of money, and the producers, directors, and actors were all helped because there was virtually no income tax in those early days. So they had lots of money, but there wasn't a whole lot of culture in Southern California at the time, and there was no sport at all. There were two football teams and college football teams, UCLA and USC, but there were no professional sports. Baseball was restricted to the East Coast. Football and basketball on the professional level were small potatoes. So they had nothing to do, no place to go to spend their money. And then along comes Prohibition in 1919. So for a long time in Southern California, you couldn't buy a drink and you couldn't get a bet down on anything. But there was Mexico over down in Tijuana, just across the border from San Diego. And they had a racetrack there. And the Hollywood type soon discovered how much fun it could be to go down to Tijuana and play the horses and go to the casinos and get a drink without having without breaking the law. And Tijuana Race Course was a very fashionable place to go. And then after a few years, some of the Americans realized how much money that could be made there, and they started Agua Caliente, where they put together a race called the Agua Caliente Handicap, which for a few years was worth $100,000. And this is in the late 20s, which is, the race was worth more than $2 million of today's money. And lots of people went down there. Raoul Walsh was always down there, and so many others were too. And then finally, the people in California realized that so many wealthy Californians, not just Hollywood film types, but regular people, were going down there, and all the tax money was going to Mexico. So they decided that they would reinstate pari-mutuel wagering. And along about the same time, the 19th Amendment prohibition was rescinded, and suddenly California was a place where you could have gambling, you could have horse racing, and you could get a drink too. And that led to the development of Santa Anita.
Okay, so the film characters wanted to have a good time, and they created a way to have that good time in their own state rather than going to Mexico. So these three racetracks opened in Southern California in the 1930s. You mentioned them. Would you tell us a bit about each one and its specific connection to Hollywood?
Well, the first was Santa Anita. There were a number of different groups who wanted to take advantage of opening a new race course. And the people, there was a great, it was like a race just to see who would have the first race course. And Hal Roach had plans of his own. Hal Roach was the head of the Hal Roach Studios. He was the producer of the Power Gang comedies, and most famously of the Laurel and Hardy of films. And he was a racing fan himself. He tried a couple of times to get a race course started. He wanted to have one near his own studio in Culver City, but the local people objected. And then he hooked up with people from San Francisco, Charles Strube, who had been a dentist in San Francisco, lost all his money in the earthquake, and then a few years later, after building his fortune back up again, lost it in the stock market crash. But he was a resourceful man, and he got his fortune back up again. And he and Roach went together, and they started. They put together Santa Anita after being stymied in a couple of places by the locals, who still didn't want to have horse racing around. And Roach and Strube put Santa Anita together, getting lots of help from a number of other people, including Bing Crosby, who was one of the regulars at Agua Caliente and was always interested in horse racing. And they built it on practically the same place where the original Santa Anita had closed in 1909, in the foothills of the San Gabriel Mountains, arguably one of the most beautiful site for a racetrack imaginable.
And then which one was next?
Well, Santa Anita got off to a great start. And there was soon the understanding that if horse racing was going to succeed in Southern California, they had to have racing more or less the year round. And this is where Bing Crosby stepped in. He had he was one of the backers of Santa Anita. He had a box on the Santa Anita finish line, and he was a sportsman. He had played basketball and baseball in college. He loved to play golf. He loved to play tennis, and he loved horses. In his biography, he said, I cannot tell my story completely unless I bring in my passion for horse flesh. Mm-hmm. And he did have a passion for horse flesh. So he got together with Pat O'Brien, and they decided they would build another race course, but not in Los Angeles, further south. They bought some property in Del Mar, right along the beach, and began agitating for a race course there. It was a long struggle. They would run out of money, and Crosby and O'Brien actually had to take out loans on their life insurance policies at one point in order to keep things going. And finally, they succeeded, and in July 1938, I think it was, they finally got Del Mar opened. And because Bing Crosby at the time was the biggest star in Hollywood, not only as an actor, but as a singer. He had had a great number of number one hit songs. In fact, just yesterday, I saw a film with him, High Society, in which it's not a horse racing film, but he sings a bunch of Cole Porter songs. He was immensely popular throughout the 30s, 40s, and 50s. And as Bob Hope once said, why did you go down there to Del Mar? And he said, well, Bing asked me. And if Bing asks, you do it. He had a lot of talent at his command, and he marshaled it together and started Del Mar, which to this day is the known as the race course where the turf meets the surf, and a song of his that he wrote is played before the first race and after the last race every day at Del Mar. And so suddenly Southern California now had two race courses, Santa Anita, where they would race in the winter and spring, and Del Mar, where they would race in the summer. But it still wasn't enough.
So Del Mar, that was another lovely place to build a racetrack. What about Hollywood Park?
Then along came Hollywood Park. Now, there's a controversy about the beginning of Hollywood Park, its origins, and it has to do with the social policies Hal Roach and Charles Stroob put together at Santa Anita. And that was that Jews could not enter the turf club in Santa Anita. Now, the grandstand at Santa Anita was divided into three areas, the grandstand, and in the same building there was the clubhouse, which you pay a few extra dollars and you have nicer amenities. But there was a separate building next to the clubhouse called the turf club. And this is where all the elites were gathering, all the elites except the Jews. Now, since most of the leading producers in Hollywood, most of the leading studios in Hollywood were run by Jews, MGM, Warner Brothers, this rankled. It was clear discrimination. And so Jack Warner and Harry Warner at Warner Brothers decided they would start a race course of their own, and they got Louis B. Mayer from MGM and just about everyone from Hollywood, whether they were Jewish or not, put their weight behind Hollywood Park. Finding an area for it was just as difficult as it had been for Santa Anita. At first, they were going to build a race course near the Veterans Center in West Hollywood, but they protested because there was a big publicity campaign. Oh, you don't want to take the few dollars that the veterans are getting and have them wasted at the race course. So they had to look around for another place. And they finally found one in Inglewood, which is just east of where Los Angeles International Airport is right now. Kind of out of the way. And when it was first opened, it wasn't called Hollywood Park. But then they soon realized that they had to call it Hollywood Park, because they wanted everyone to know that this was Hollywood's race course, even though it was probably about 15 miles from Hollywood Boulevard. And so Hollywood opened, and everybody could go there regardless of race, color, creed, or religion. And suddenly Southern California had three race tracks, and business was booming. They were open all but a 5 or 6 weeks of the year in Southern California for racing.
So, you know, that's rather shocking to hear that history, although certainly there was plenty of discrimination against Jews in the United States in the 1930s. But, you know, given that you would think these are really powerful people in Hollywood, and you would think they would have a lot of cultural sort of cachet, but what percentage do you know of people, you know, sort of the bigwigs in Hollywood were Jewish at this time?
Well, Benito Mussolini, the fascist leader of Italy, once opined that there are more Jews in Hollywood than there are in Tel Aviv. Of course, he was exaggerating. He was a fascist after all. Hal Roach was a lifelong admirer of Benito Mussolini and once entertained his son at his studios, introduced him to the Our Gang kids. There's a famous picture of Spanky, Alfalfa, and Darla all gathered around Mussolini's son. Mussolini himself was interested in film. He built Cinecittà, the great film studio in Rome, and his son wanted to promote film, and that's why he went to Hollywood to see what was going on there. And he knew of Roach's admiration for his father, and so the two worked together. But this is evidence that of what was going on in Hollywood, even with the Jews dominating the film industry, calling probably 4/5 of all the shots in Hollywood. There was still room for discrimination, and Charles Strube and Hal Roach found it and would not allow Jews into the turf club, which is where all the business deals, whether they were film or racing deals or other kinds of deals, were made, which is where all the top class socializing was taking place. And since Del Mar was at the time only an August track, that means that the only racetrack that was in Southern California where on a regular basis, Santa Anita, the most exclusive area, was denied to Jews. But with the opening of Hollywood, they didn't have that problem. And they didn't have that problem at Del Mar either. Bing Crosby was an open-minded man, and he wasn't about to deny Jews or anyone else access to any area.
So you think a lot of it had to do with Hal Roach's attitudes toward Jews?
We know more about Hal Roach because he's a more famous figure than Charles Strube, but Strube was involved too. And the people that they had close to them were involved. There's a film that they made about discrimination against Jews in Hollywood, Gentleman's Agreement. It was all very pleasant and gentlemanly, above board. There were no beatings of Jews. There were no public arguments. It was all very gentlemanly and quietly handled, which made it almost invisible. But it was certainly felt by the Jewish producers and directors. Mm-hmm. Who were being excluded.
Yeah. And so is that how it was done at Santa Anita too? Because I don't imagine that they would have had a sign on the door saying no Jews allowed.
No. Well, Jewish discrimination, I think, is not quite the same as discrimination against blacks.
Yeah.
You can see who's black. But with Jews, it's not that way. It was much more subtle a kind of thing, but at least as effective.
Yeah. And didn't Hal Roach actually start a film company with the son of Mussolini Jr.?
Yes, he did. And it was racked with all sorts of problems. There was a deal that Roach would put money into pictures that would be made in Italy at Cinecittà. And it just didn't take off. After there were lawsuits involved, and ultimately it all fell apart.
Well, maybe just as well. So let's go to another character, Louis B. Mayer. And he's famous as the head of MGM, Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer. And as you write, he also had a near obsession with thoroughbred racing and breeding, or maybe it was an obsession. The book has a fascinating chart depicting Mayer's racing and breeding results year by year, and it's alongside a column of the MGM movie releases that occurred under his reign, and some of them included The Wizard of Oz, The Philadelphia Story, Woman of the Year, Lassie Come Home, National Velvet, The Postman Always Rings Twice, Little Women. So he certainly had plenty to keep him busy. But what were some of Mayer's most notable racing exploits?
Well, Mayer was not originally a racing fan. Even as racing was booming, he would contribute to the development of Hollywood Park, and he would be at Santa Anita. He had a box at Santa Anita, and he had a box at Del Mar, but it wasn't really something that he was very much interested in. He had some physical problems. He went to a doctor, and the doctor said, "You need a hobby," He wasn't a very athletic person, so he wasn't going to take up swimming or golf or tennis. And someone recommended horse racing, where you can just sit back and you know, to buy horses, bet on horses, watch horses. It's a nice pastime, and you can sit all afternoon and watch it from your seat in the grandstand. So he got together a team which, in racing terms, was the equal of the team that he had put together at MGM, which was by far the leading studio in the 1930s. And he started to buy racehorses with the advice of all these top people from Kentucky in England on what he ought to do. And, you know, Mayer was a genius. He rose to the top of the film world, and almost as soon as he started getting interested in horse racing, he rode to the top of the racing world. He knew from the advice he had been given that the key to success in racing is through breeding. And so he wanted to buy good stallions and good mares to begin to develop his own good racehorses. First one he went after was Man O' War, who would revolutionize American racing in 1920 and became the most popular thoroughbred racehorse up to that time. He offered Sam Riddle, Man O' War's owner, $1 million for Man O' War. And Sam Riddle said, no, absolutely not. He I'm not going to do that. Years later, Riddle said he was afraid that Mayer would use Man O' War in one of his horses, in one of his pictures, which tells you something about what the non-racing world thought. It tells you something what the racing world thought of people out in Southern California, that they were only dilettantes, Mayer didn't know what he was doing. Well, Mayer did know what he was doing. He didn't get Man O' War. So then he tried to get Hyperion, who had been a champion in England and it looked like he was going to become the next great stallion in the world. And in fact, that's exactly what he did. Hyperion's influence is all over the thoroughbred map, even today. So he offered Lord Derby, Hyperion's owner, $1 million for Hyperion. And Lord Derby took umbrage, and he said famously, though England lay in ashes, Hyperion will never leave these shores. And Hyperion never did leave these shores. But Mayer was undeterred. And the next year, he had his people searching around, and he came across a young foal by Hyperion, named unnamed foal, and he bought it for 3,200 guineas, which was about $10,000 at the time. And he brought it to Southern California, and by this time, Mayer had already put together a farm outside of Los Angeles, southeast of Los Angeles. And this horse came there. He named it Alibi. And in early workouts, it was burning up the track. In fact, the legend is that one day Alibi broke the track record at Santa Anita in a workout for 1 mile, which is really quite astounding. He was getting ready for his first race, and a few days before it, he had a workout and bowed a tendon really badly, so badly that he had to be retired. And he never ran. But Mayer started breeding horses with him, and Alibi became one of the leading stallions of his period. He sired your host, who would eventually sire Kelso, the five-time winner of the Jockey Club Gold Cup. Alibi sired Determine, who won the Kentucky Derby. He also sired Flower Bowl, for whom there is still a race named in at Belmont Park. Flower Bowl would be the dam of Grostark and His Majesty, two of the leading stallions of the 60s and 70s. Mayer had the golden touch.
But that's amazing, because you couldn't do that these days. You couldn't take a stallion who had never raced, a colt who had never raced, and turn him into a major stallion.
Yeah, that's it's expertise on the part of Mayer and his team, but it's also luck, because in order to succeed in racing, you need expertise and luck. And Mayer had them both in spades. He also sired the last big horse that he sired was that he bred. Mayer was Royal Orbit, who won the Preakness Stakes 1958, I think it was.
With that, is, as you say, he must have had extraordinary luck or extraordinary genius combined with good luck, because you, as you write, there were a lot of other of these movie stars or studio heads who put a lot of money into trying to build a powerful racing stable, and they weren't very successful at it.
And the classic example of that is Harry Warner over at MGM's rivals, Warner Brothers. Mervyn LeRoy, the great director, married Harry Warner's daughter, so they were father-in-law and son-in-law. They both liked racing, especially LeRoy, so they pooled their resources and they started buying horses, and they bought horses and bought horses for 20 years, but they never had a stakes winner. They had winners. I imagine that they you know, they didn't lose too much money, but unlike Mayer, they were basically busts at the game.
Yeah. So Mayer, tell me this. How did he manage to produce all of those major, major films and produce all of these major racehorses and go to the race? How did he have the time to do all that?
Well, he probably didn't have the time. But one must remember that Louis B. Mayer wasn't a producer in the sense that Irving Thalberg was a producer. Irving Thalberg was the man who would put hands on and oversee every step of a production of a film. Louis B. Mayer was a step higher than that, and he just delegated responsibility. In fact, he delegated his responsibility once he started getting interested in racing to a point where the other executives at MGM became worried about what he was doing. Mayer started spending so much time at Santa Anita or Hollywood or Del Mar or at his farm southeast of Los Angeles or at morning workouts talking with trainers and owners and jockeys to get inside information that the executives at MGM began to worry about what he was doing. This was during the war years in the 1940s. They had a code at MGM. It was something along the lines of someone would ask, where is Louis today? And they would say, oh, he's on set 17, or he's on set 18, which didn't exist. Set 17 was code for Hollywood Park. Set 18 was code for Santa Anita. And there wasn't much that the underlings in Los Angeles could do about it. But the boss, even Louis B. Mayer had a boss, and that boss was back in New York in the form of Mr. Skank, who was in charge of Lowe's Incorporated. They owned MGM, and they were the distributors. And that's where he started to get in trouble. And finally, he had to make a decision about whether he would continue with MGM exclusively or continue with racing and MGM. And he had to sell off all his horses, but not before he had a couple of the best racehorses of the mid-1940s.
Oh, wow. What a tale. You could make a movie about it.
Yeah, you could make a movie about it. and they do make movies about individual racehorses. There's the movies about Seabiscuit and Secretariat.
Yes.
Mayer's legacy in breeding, it can be found just by looking at the horse's bloodlines. But he did have a couple of really top-class fillies. Busher was the first one. But unlike so many of the horses that Mayer had, he was not bred by Mayer. Colonel Edward R. Bradley had been in charge of Idlehour Farm, and anyone who's at least as old as I am, 75, will remember Idlehour Farm. They were one of the great racing and breeding operations in Kentucky, right up there with the Whitneys and the Vanderbilts and Calumet Farm. Well, Colonel Edward R. Bradley had suffered some setbacks in the 40s, and he was offering a number of horses up for sale, including Busher, who had been named two-year-old filly champion, racing exclusively in the New York circuit, Belmont, Aqueduct, Saratoga. And he offered Busher to Louis B. Mayer, who snapped him up, and became one of the great racehorses of the era. Busher won consecutively the Santa Susana Stakes in Southern at Santa Anita, a race which would eventually be known as the Santa Anita Oaks. Then he beat Colts in the San Vicente Stakes. Then he was second in the Santa Anita Derby, the Southern California prep for the Kentucky Derby. Then he won the Santa Margarita back against Phillies, the Cleopatra Handicap. Then he was sent to Chicago. In those days, racing in Chicago was, racing in Chicago these days hardly exists anymore with the closure of Arlington Park. But there were a lot of good races in the summertime in at Washington Park, including the Arlington Handicap, which he won against Colts. Then he won the Washington Park Handicap, which was a race that was basically as good as the Jockey Club Gold Cup is these days. A race in which he beat Arm, the two-time champion handicap horse, Polynesian, the Preakness Stakes winner, and Gallarette, a champion filly. And she was giving weight to all of those horses, a three-year-old filly giving weight to older colts and fillies and beating them. Then she came back to Hollywood and won the Hollywood Derby, and the Vanity Handicap was named three-year-old filly champion, older filly or mare handicap champion, and horse of the year, and was rated the 40th best racehorse of the 20th century in the United States. Astonishing record.
So whatever he paid for her, it was probably worth it.
Yeah, and one could see why Mayer enjoyed horse racing. It's a social event. It's a venue for gambling, and it's an equine sport, and Mayer enjoyed this. And then the following year, in 1946, a horse that he bred by Honeymoon, who was by Beaupère, an Australian horse. It shows you how far-reaching Mayer was. He not only bought horses from England, like Alibi, but he would go to Australia and pick up a good stallion like Beaupère, who was the sire of Honeymoon, who won seven stakes races in 1946, but was just short of championship quality. She didn't win any championship, but she did get a race named after her, named the Honeymoon Handicap, which is still run it's run at Del Mar now. It used to be run, of course, at Hollywood until Hollywood closed in 2013.
Yeah. And just for anyone who doesn't know, who's listening, a filly is a young female horse.
Right. They're fillies when they're 2, 3, and 4. And then when they're 5, they become mares.
Yeah. And they don't usually run against the males.
They don't usually, but Buescher did and did it successfully.
Yeah. So another well-known Hollywood personality, Fred Astaire, he also had a passion for horse racing. And in fact, there's a well-known horse named after him more recently. But Fred Astaire is among the most well-known names in Hollywood. Still, I would be surprised if many people were aware that he was married for 7 years until the day of his death to one of the pioneering female jockeys. So would you tell us about that relationship and how it came about?
Well, Astaire had gotten interested in horse racing when he was in England, appearing in shows in the West End. At that time, horse racing was the national sport in England, and especially amongst the show business people, everybody had an idea on what was going to win the 350 at Sandown or the 245 at Epsom. And Astaire got interested. He started playing the horses, and then when he came back to Hollywood, he started buying horses. I think his most famous horse was probably Triplicate, who won a couple of big races, including the San Juan Capistrano at Santa Anita. But as he got older, he wasn't owning horses anymore, but he was still going to the races. And in 1973, on New Year's Day, he was at Santa Anita when he was introduced to Robin Smith, who was there to ride that day. She was riding in an allowance race, a horse named Exciting Divorce. And the owner introduced him to Robin Smith, and Robin Smith duly won the race by a nose at a long price, beating a Bill Shoemaker ridden odds-on favorite. So Astaire certainly had some money on Robin Smith that day. But 5 years went by before they ever saw each other again. Robin Smith was based basically in New York, where she had great success. She was really the first really successful woman jockey. But she was also quite attractive, and she was used as a model sometimes. And she was out in Los Angeles to make a commercial for Shasta soft drinks. And she just cold called Fred Astaire up on the telephone and said, "Hi, remember me?" And he said, "Oh, I certainly do." And she asked him out to dinner. And so they went out to dinner, and they went out to dinner again. And soon they became an item. And they fell in love. And Robin Smith moved her tack out to Southern California so she could be near Fred more often. And they got married.
And he was considerably older.
Oh, I think he was like 77 when they got married or something around there. And of course, she was, you know, in what, her mid or late 20s, old enough to be her grandfather.
Yeah,
but
and we should mention
he was a charming fellow, and he was very famous, and he was very wealthy.
Yeah, he was very, and he could dance.
And he could dance. Rachel had a tough upbringing. She was an orphan, and she was basically unloved as a little girl. And I guess she had stars in her eyes, and she saw her chance, and she took it.
Yeah, and we should mention that women were only started being licensed as jockeys in 1969. So when he met her in 73, it wasn't long after that.
No, that's right. And then they got married in 78.
Yeah. So, an unknown aspect of Fred Astaire's life to a lot of people.
Yeah.
And
I mean,
there are a lot of – go on.
Well, you know, Robin Smith wasn't riding until the 1970s. In England, women could ride. Hmm. Then we have the famous fictional horse race in National Velvet.
Oh, yes.
Where Elizabeth Taylor, and with the help of Mickey Rooney, trains a horse up to the Grand National, arguably the most difficult horse race to ride in the world. Hmm. And on the morning of the race, when the jockey for her horse shows up drunk, they have to replace him. And who replaces him but Elizabeth Taylor herself, 12-year-old girl who's never ridden in a race before, doesn't have a license, and is suddenly riding in the most difficult race in the world and wins. National Velvet is probably the most popular and famous of all the racing films ever made. But it's a pure fairy tale. It's a fantasy.
And yet it manages to convince you.
It's very well made. I mean, it is a very good film. It won the Oscar for best editing, especially the editing of the race itself, which was conducted on a golf course in Pasadena.
Was it?
Yes, and where you can.
Disillusioned.
They did a very good job. Of the canal turn, which is the turn at the far end of the race course where the horses jump and immediately have to make a 90-degree left-hand turn. They did a very good job with that. The problem is you could see that the grass is much shorter than it would be at Aintree, and that the sun was shining like it only does in Pasadena and never does in Liverpool.
In Liverpool. And the Grand National was actually a tougher course then than it is now. They've tamed it a little bit since then.
Every few years they seem to make one or another of the fences a bit easier, especially Beecher's Brook. Mm-hmm. They just make it. The landing side used to be at least a foot lower than the jumping side. Though they made that even, and they made the brook, the water part, not as wide. And the traditionalists don't like that sort of thing. They think it should be really tough. I mean, it's supposed to resemble the sort of things that horses would go through in. On the battlefield, and the national course at Aintree is certainly a battlefield.
It is still pretty wild and woolly, though.
Mm-hmm.
There's still a lot of horses that don't make it around the course. So You mentioned National Velvet, so let's just talk about racing movies now. And you write that there were at least 60 racing-themed films in the 1930s, which is a lot, and about 120 overall from the 1930s to the 1960s. What purpose did the film serve, and how popular, or even how good were they?
Well, the great interest that Hollywood had in horse racing was reflected in the great number of racing films that Hollywood produced. But it wasn't just because Louis B. Mayer and Harry Warner and Bing Crosby and Fred Astaire liked horse racing. It was because America liked horse racing. In the 1930s, 40s, and 50s, I would argue that horse racing was the most popular sport in the United States, even more popular than baseball, because there were more racetracks around the country, and it was horse racing was really the only place in the time where you could get down a legal bet. Casino gambling was illegal. Sports betting was illegal. There were no lotteries. Yeah, you could get a bet down with your local bookie, and there was plenty of betting for horse racing done with local bookies because not everybody could get to a racetrack every day. But the number of racing films that they made was a reflection of what the people in Hollywood liked and a reflection of what Americans were doing. And that's why Americans took to them. Now, the genre of the horse racing film, it cannot be thought of as one of the most important in the history of Hollywood. They're not musicals. They're not film noirs. They're not westerns. They're not romantic dramas. They fall pretty short of that, generally speaking. But what the producers would do is they would make Hollywood, they would make racing films adapt to what Hollywood was doing. There were racing films that were musicals, like Going Places, which stars Dick Powell in his when he was still a crooner, and has Louis Armstrong and a number of black singers. They do a tremendous number halfway through the film that lasts for about 15 minutes. I would call them fractured nursery rhymes. They would take nursery rhymes and to jazz arrangements, they would reimagine them. And it's a tour de force, a 15-minute section of just great entertaining music. And there would be film noirs. There would be films like The Killing, this Stanley Kubrick film about a heist at Bay Meadows Racetrack. The Ex-Mrs. Bradford, which was William Powell and Gene Arthur solving a murder mystery. They would make screwball comedies like A Day at the Races with the Marx Brothers. So racing films reflected all of these things. Now, outside of National Velvet, which won for an Oscar for Best Editing and won Anne Revere won the Oscar for Best Supporting Actress, and it was nominated for Best Color Cinematography. Trying to find a really great racing film is difficult. They weren't all that good, but they were entertaining, and lots of them made money.
And now it's interesting because you mentioned betting is a part of going to the races, and it's a big attraction for a lot of people. And yet, most of those movies were not about betting at the racetrack, were they?
It's about 50-50. Hmm. When they were about betting, they were usually about fixed races. This was a genre that had started really in England in the 1920s in silent films. The English made loads of pictures that were about racing, and almost every one of them was about a fixed race or a crooked jockey. And Hollywood followed up in that vein with a number of pictures. And they also made pictures about the effort for their horse to win the big race so that they could save the farm or get the operation for the little girl or save the Broadway show. Broadway Bill is one of those. Those kinds of pictures, there were films like Down Argentine Way, which holds a particular place in the history of the racing film. This is one of the better racing productions. It was made at the behest of the American government in 1940. The government prodded Hollywood into making films to make nice to Latin American and South American countries in the run-up to World War II. The Germans were very influential in South America, and Washington wanted to get their 2 cents in by showing how much America appreciated Latin American and South American countries. And there were lots of such films made set in Mexico and Brazil, and Down Argentine Way was supposedly set in Argentina. Well, they didn't quite get it right. Their intentions were good. It starred Betty Grable and Don Ameche. Betty Grable herself played an American horsewoman who goes down to Argentina to try and buy some horses from Don Ameche, who plays an Argentine horse owner and breeder. It was a musical. Don Ameche and Betty Grable sing the theme song, and along the way we run into the Nicholas brothers, the Torres brothers, and what was her name? The Chiquita Banana girl with the bananas in her head.
Oh, I can't remember.
Anyway, the problem was the Nicholas brothers were Americans, the Torres brothers were Mexicans, and this movie star whose name escapes us was Brazilian.
Was it Carmen something?
Carmen Miranda?
Miranda, yeah.
Carmen Miranda,
yeah.
Right. She was Brazilian, so there were no Argentines. This was bad enough, but the real problem with Down Argentine Way was the racing scenes. Betty Grable is with Don Ameche, and Don Ameche and his trainer suddenly get the bright idea that a horse that has been the equestrian champion in Argentina for the last 2 years should now be returned to the racetrack and run in the races, which is quite fanciful. And the big race in question is something that looks like the Gran Premio Carlos Pellegrini at San Isidro. The Carlos Pellegrini is the South American equivalent to the Prix de l'Arc de Triomphe, which is the most important race in Europe and arguably the world. So they get this horse ready for this race, and the producers and the director, Irving Cummings, decide that it'll be a fixed race. And they have the horse in question ridden by a jockey who's in the pay of the gangsters, and he's going to pull the race. Well, as things go on, the horse wins the race anyway, and so everything is nice and a happy ending, and Betty Grable goes home back to America very happy, and everyone lives happily ever after, except the Argentine authorities. What the producers at 20th Century Fox didn't understand was that the jockey club in Argentina sitteth at the right hand of almost everything that happens in Argentina. Carlos Pellegrini was the founder of the jockey club. The big race was named after him. And in Argentina, even to this day, if you want to be a top success in politics, business, or sport, you have to be a member of the jockey club. Now, for the Americans to show a race in Argentina that was fixed was an insult not only to the jockey club, but to the Argentine nation. And the president of Argentina was so outraged, he sent a personal letter to Franklin Roosevelt, protesting the depiction of Argentine racing and Argentine society in this film. The film was never shown in Argentina, even though it was a big success around the United States. So, you know, the efforts to try and keep Argentina on the American side didn't make it, at least not in the form of Down Argentine Way. And as you know, Argentina, after the war, was a good hiding place for ex-Nazis. Hmm.
Well, but it just goes to show you how, you know, the sort of deep embedding of horse racing in human culture. And I guess that's some of what even the movies about fixing races, and ostensibly it's about fixing the odds and people making a killing or not on their bets. But it's really about human nature, isn't it?
And it goes way, way back. You could argue that the first film ever made was a horse racing film. Leland Stanford, back in the 1870s, was a wealthy man in San Francisco. He's the founder of Stanford University. And there was always controversy back then, before the age of film, whether a horse actually picked up all four of his legs when he was at a full gallop. I mean, men would argue over this point. You may recall the paintings that were made in the 18th and 19th centuries of horses at full gallop are ridiculous. You see pictures of horses with their front legs splayed forward, their back legs splayed backwards, and their bellies are like just a few inches off the ground. This is what artists, who are supposed to have keen vision, saw when they saw horses running. And so there was lots of debate. And Leland Stanford got into an argument with some people one day, and he said, yes, horses do lift all four of their hooves off the ground. And the other guy said no. So they had a big bet, and Leland Stanford hired Edward Muybridge, the British photographer who had been living in California. They set up a track with a straight track with trip wires attached to the latest high-speed cameras. And they had a rider and a horse run over through the track with a white background. And as he was running, he would trip the wires and a photo would be taken. And so there were a series of photos taken of this horse in this exercise. And when they were developed, they showed clearly that for a few instants, horses do indeed raise all four of their hooves off the ground. And what Muybridge did was then he invented something called a praxeoscope. It was like a magic lantern, an early magic lantern, where you take the photographs and you set them in this circular thing and you flash a light on it and it flashes a moving image up on the screen. And so he did that with all of the pictures he had taken of this horse in this experiment. And this, you know, this was really the first film was a horse racing film.
Oh, fascinating. What year was that?
Oh, yeah, it was back in the 1870s. I can't remember exactly.
Huh? It's kind of like when you draw the, you know, little picture on the edges of the margins of a book and then you flip it with your thumb and it makes a...
Well, there are lots of flip books, you know. The boy used to have them. In fact, I have one of King Kong showing him on the top of the Empire State Building, taken from the point of view of the airplane pilot who's shooting him down.
We used to have such fun as children before they got all these...
Everything is on a computer.
Devices, exactly. Yes. Yeah.
Well, the medium is the message, as they say. And certainly the medium of the computer, the laptop and all that is... That is what people are doing. I fear for things like reading and film going the way of people who don't see anything but computerized moving images.
Yeah. So on that note, Alan, the end of the book, it really ends on a sober note, and it details what you call the decline and fall of both horse racing and movies in the United States. So why do you see both endeavors as failing?
Well, you know, I can remember going to the movies in the 60s and 70s. I've seen pictures of people going to the movies in the 30s and 40s, and people don't go to the movies anymore, not in the great numbers that they used to. And I can remember going to the races myself. The first time the first time I ever saw a horse race was 1957 when Bold Ruler won the Flamingo Stakes on television. I didn't go to the races again until 1973 because in order to go to the races, you've got to have a little extra money. So I was 25 years old, and by then I had a little extra money. And the day that I went was the day that Secretariat won the Belmont Stakes. Again, it was beginner's luck. I saw one of the greatest racehorse performances of all time. But it was 5 years before I started going again regularly. And I remember that was 1978. I live in New York, and I went out to Belmont on a Sunday afternoon in July. The feature race was an ungraded stake, and there were 30,000 people in the stands. And this was like a dozen years after New York City off-track betting had come along. Some people think that off-track betting hurt horse racing, but it didn't. People still went out to the races. 3 days later, I went out on a Wednesday afternoon to Belmont. 13,000 people were in the stands. For the last 15 years, the only crowds in New York at Belmont or Aqueduct that exceed 13,000 are at the Belmont Stakes. They're lucky if they get 1,500 people out at Belmont for a Saturday or Sunday afternoon. People will still go to the Kentucky Derby, the Preakness, and the Belmont, to the Breeders' Cup. Every track has its big race, the Santa Anita Handicap, the Florida Derby, the Arkansas Derby. And there are the special meetings at Saratoga, Del Mar, and Keeneland. But nowadays, people go to the races, people watch the races almost exclusively to bet. And the betting people who bet horses at home on their computers do not become racing fans. And it's from the racing fans that racing produces owners, trainers, jockeys, racetrack administrators, racetrack employees, and racing writers. And we're losing out on all of that because people don't go to the races, just as we're losing out on in the film industry. The golden age is over, the post-golden age is over, and racing was fashionable, and amongst the very fashionable Hollywood types, it reached peaks of popularity. And that's gone now.
So why is that? Is it with racing in the movies? Is it because people are now can do everything through their screens? Is that why people don't go to the movies and the races anymore? Is there something else?
That's one reason. It's certainly a reason for horse racing. The people who run racing over the last 30 or 40 years have made a mistake in marketing the sport only as a venue for betting, when in fact racing is a three-pronged activity. Venue for betting, it's an equine sport in which the characters, the horses, the trainers, and the jockeys are just as interesting as football, baseball, and basketball players. But racing doesn't market itself that way. And it is a social occasion, unlike any other sport. If you go to a baseball, football, or basketball game, you plunk yourself down in your seat and you watch the game for 2.5 or 3 hours. But at a racetrack, you have to know how to behave. It's like a mini version of the world itself. You have to know how to behave, to walk around a racetrack, study the form, look at the odds, get online, place your bet, watch the race, go to the paddock, see the horses before the race, go to the winner's circle, see the horses after the race, have a beer between races. And at each one of these places, you talk it over with whoever you happen to meet. You can go into the track restaurant and have dinner or lunch. Belmont Park doesn't even have such a place like that anymore. That you can get a buffet supper, but there's no place to sit down and get a formal lunch anymore. So all the social connotations in racing have gone by the boards, and in fact, horse racing has fallen off the American social and sporting schedule, except on those rare big days like the Breeders' Cup, which we just had this past weekend. People just aren't interested anymore. In fact, I had trouble getting this book, Hollywood at the Races, published because I would go to a commercial publisher, and as soon as horse racing was mentioned, I could tell they walked away from it. They weren't interested. And so I got it published by the University Press of Kentucky, in a state which is still interested in horse racing.
In horse racing.
But wasn't not a major publisher.
Yeah. And what about movies? What's happened there?
It's difficult for me to put my finger on it. The decline of American culture or world culture, because films are not really prospering anywhere else. France still makes some very nice films. But I think the new technologies, the home environment, the home entertainment environment has really hurt. Hollywood was frightened to death of television when it came along in 1948. They tried everything from 3D to wide screens to road shows and big hooplas and everything. And they held television off quite well until the 1980s, when things really started to go haywire. François Truffaut, the great French filmmaker, once said that in order for a film to be successful, it must possess two characteristics. It must tell the truth, and it must be un spectacle. It must be a show. It must entertain. Now, most American films these days fall into one or the other category. You've got the great blockbusters, the Marvel comic book films, which are all entertainment and show tell no truth at all. And then you have the independent films, which have arisen in in opposition to these terrible blockbusters, but have gone to the other extreme. They tell a certain brand of the truth about one's personal life, or first falling in love, first having sex, or first getting divorced, or growing up and learning about the world. Things which don't have any great interest to the general public. These films tell the truth, but they're not entertaining. And I think the American public why should they go out and see these things? They're even hard pressed sometimes to buy them on Netflix. Netflix is apparently quite a bit of trouble. They don't even bother to watch these things at home. And this is all very disconcerting because racing and going to the movies are both and still are convivial experiences, communal experiences. You go out and you experience something with like-minded people, but it's difficult to do that when you go to a racetrack and there are fewer than 1,000 people at the racetrack, or if you go into a 500-seat movie theater and there are only 7 or 8 people in the theater.
Yeah, it's not
as much fun. David Lynch, who made a number of terrific films, said a few years ago that he wasn't going to make any more movies because there is no longer a film culture in America. Well, a few weeks later, he rescinded that, and he said that he might make new films, but he hasn't, and it's 5 years since we've had a film from him, and he's right. There is no film culture in America the way there used to be, the way names of films and movie stars would be on the tips of everyone's tongues. And the same with horse racing. Jockeys like Eddie Arcaro and Bill Shoemaker and Angel Cordero, you could go into a bar and mention these names in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, and everybody would know who you were talking about. But now, if you mention the top riders in America, Errat Ortiz, Joel Rosario, Florent Giroux, or Flavien Prat, nobody knows what you're talking about.
Well, I sat on you, but there's so much wonderful history here to read. And I want to remind everyone, the book is called Hollywood at the Races, Film's Love Affair with the Turf by Alan Schubach. And Alan, thank you so much for this really stimulating and fascinating talk.
You're welcome, Rachel.